One of the delightful parts of my ministry here has been meeting colleagues in the area. And one of these friends that I have made is a local rabbi. And recently I asked if I could attend some of his Torah study sessions. The conversations have been deep and meaningful and have introduced me to new details about the Hebrew Scriptures. Recently, this included a revisit to the ancient creation story of Genesis. Now, on the surface, this all sounds familiar to most of us. It tells of how the world was created in 7 days, the plants and animals were made on different days, and then Adam and Eve were created last. The story is often interpreted, sometimes in Jewish tradition, sometimes in Christian tradition, is saying that humans are God's crowning achievement. And because of this hierarchical status, God gives human beings dominion over the earth and all of its creatures. Creaturely life and plant life are ours to do with what we will. But what surprised me in rereading Genesis this time is that there is another, very different version of the story just a few verses down. I had never looked at the two versions side by side, but they both exist in the book of Genesis. I had assumed that they were somewhat similar and was just mostly reading them through the lens of that version that I had already known. But there are some important differences. In the second version, God creates the earth, but refuses to create plants or animals. God also refuses to allow it to rain. This is because, and I quote, "there was not a human being to till the ground." Once Adam is created, the garden can also be made. In this story, human beings still maintain an important status. But this is the important difference here. That status does not confer upon human beings dominion or control. Instead, it creates obligation, a responsibility to till the soil, to protect it, to make it into a garden that will flourish. It is a shame that the second version of the creation story has not received a wider hearing in our culture. At best, it sounds like a distant echo of the first, which is much more culturally available. This first narrative, the dominionist narrative, has deeply impacted the ways that the West has understood and talked about nature. The story has, according to eco-theologian Sally McFaig, an immediate credibility upon first hearing. She does not mean that because people automatically buy all of the details, including the parts about naked people in an apple orchard with a crafty snake. But what comes off to most folks as seductive, familiar, as a part of our cultural DNA is the meta-narrative that's contained within it, this idea that we human beings have dominion over the earth. Indeed, this idea continues to impact not only theological conversation, but also the political realm. As one far-right commentator pretty crassly put it, "God gave us the earth. We have dominion over the plants, the animals, the trees. God said, 'Earth is yours. Take it, rape it. It's yours.'" This logic has devastating consequences, ones that are easy to trace. All we have to do is look at the current situation with the EPA. Its story over the last 2 years has been one of consistent deregulation, and until very recently, a climate change denier has headed the agency to boot. A piece of what motivated his politics and his policies is his Christian beliefs, and particularly his interpretation of the book of Genesis. Because of his reading of that story, he believes that oil and coal are gifts from God, resources that we have a right to manage and cultivate and share with humanity. Again, this is the person who just until recently was in charge of the Environmental Protection Agency. The Indian writer Amitav Ghosh looks at facts such as these and wonders if we are simply crazy. In his 2018 book, The Great Derangement, he writes, "Are we deranged? Future generations may well think so. How else are we to explain our imaginative failure in the face of global warming?" He continues by adding that after everything that human beings have accomplished, we are witnessing and participating in a stunning and shocking inability at the level of literature and history and politics to grasp the scale and violence of climate change. Beyond some dystopian nightmares, literature cannot seem to grapple with solutions. Scientists struggle to do anything more than simply get their point across, which hasn't been happening very well. And politics cannot seem to do anything but repeat stale talking points. There are exceptions to this, minor developments on the margin of literature and religion and history and politics, but these have not impacted the dominant dominionist worldview. The theology that emerges from the first chapter of Genesis is, as I mentioned, it's called dominion theology because God is said to give human beings dominion over the animal and plant kingdom. But I wonder increasingly, in light of current circumstance, if we haven't gotten it backwards. It's not dominion theology because we have dominion over the earth, but rather because that theology has claimed dominion over us, threatening us with nearly apocalyptic violence. This is bad news. And the response to this bad news from some environmentalists has been one of despair. It is a despair that goes much deeper than a political despair. It's an existential moral despair. With the magnitude of suffering that human beings have inflicted, some have wondered whether the world wouldn't be better off if we were gone. Last month, Todd May, a professor of philosophy at Columbia University, wrote a New York Times op-ed piece proposing this very question. He writes that because of the damage that we human beings have done, because of the many species that we have caused to go extinct and the havoc that we have reaped with plastic and with air pollution, it might very well be the case that our disappearance would be a good thing. A tragedy, he says, because like the ancient Greek heroes, we will have brought about our own destruction despite our best efforts, but also for the sake of Earth, and for the sake of life, a good thing. What I notice about the dominant poles of this current discussion is that they start from the same premise. Whether we believe that the natural world is something given to us to be exploited, or whether we toy with ideas such as human derangement or human erasure, the assumption is that our presence is necessarily an exploitative, adversarial one. Both arguments start with something like this. Human beings lay waste to the earth, and as long as we are here, that is what we are going to do. For as smart as we are as a species, we cannot seem to imagine another alternative, a different way of interacting with nature and a future that doesn't end an ecological disaster. Now today we have a special guest in the service, in case you didn't hear us the first 5 or 6 or 10 times we've mentioned it already. It's a cast of Sue's head, and Sue is a 67 million year old T-Rex. Sue's story is both majestic and inspiring. In Sue's time, she was a flight attendant with an extensive butterfly collection and a penchant for romance novels. And she also loved the Super Bowl. I'm just kidding. Her story is majestic because it communicates the profundity of evolution, the story of life that is amazingly complex, ancient beyond our ability to comprehend, and includes impressive creatures such as Sue. And I wonder if there is something in evolution so forcefully represented by the presence of Sue that might invite us to think about these environmental problems in a different way. Evolution occurs through accidental shifts, the strange emergence of new traits that are then favored. Frequently, these traits show up on the margins in a few individuals and then become more and more dominant. Usually, this happens slowly, but sometimes a radical shift can occur where a species will develop wings or a new limb with little indication that that was going to happen. And then those traits are favored in subsequent generations, and a leap forward takes place. This happens at the level of human consciousness, too. Views evolve, and one day something that was unthinkable suddenly becomes thinkable. These shifts are sometimes slow, sometimes incremental, but other times, as in the case of marriage equality, they can happen suddenly and with incredible rapidity. They can occur within a matter of years. A different story begins to take precedence. Even Amitav Ghosh, who writes eloquently of how we are in the thralls of a great derangement, admits that there are other possibilities, ways of thinking that are on the margins that could change the dominant habit of understanding our relation to the environment. Some of these ways, I would suggest, are not even that new. Some are quite old, extending to civilizations long gone, to a story where humanity is created not to have dominion over the earth, but rather to be responsible for caring for it, entrusted to cherish it. Maybe the breakthrough to a new way of being, of living, of caring for our earth could start with that story. Perhaps somewhere in that telling, long ago and often forgotten, there is the catalyst for an evolutionary leap in thought, an emergence into a new way of thinking about the world where we are its caretakers. Marge Piercy said that whatever we do, whichever stories we claim, whatever efforts we set forward, it's going to be rough improvisation. She writes in her poem that the world, incomplete, becoming, was given to us to fix, to complete, and we've almost worn it out. But she finishes with a call to try, to awake to the day anew and begin again. As she puts it, every dawn I choose to take up a knife to the world's flank or a sewing kit. It's rough improvisation, but it's a start. Piercy captures here beautifully the essence of the task that is laid before us. What is required is more than despair, even if that is what we sometimes feel. What is required is more than preoccupation with our current forms of derangement, even if those seem overwhelming and demoralizing. What is required is a new improvisation, a building from parts that we find most useful, the holding forth of the possibility of an evolution into a new way of living with the earth. So let us do that. Let us pick up the knife or the sewing kit and begin our work on the world's flank. It will no doubt be rough improvisation, but it's a start.